Hi, nice to meet you.
Hi, Phil Gonzalez.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. It's so weird to put faces to
emails. I know, yeah.
To emails.
Always talk to emails, yeah.
Our assistant.
Hi, I'm Brad.
Nice to meet you.
Hey, I'm Jeremy.
Hello.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
I'm Phil.
Nice to meet
nice
you.
Nice to meet you.
Well, this is our studio. I work in here. Marianne works in here. Eleanor works in here. Mm-hmm. We also have a little financial office. That's where my brother Leo works.
Oh, wonderful.
Okay. He's not here today, but
excellent.
He comes and goes.
So yes.
That's where the boring stuff happens.
Right.
But anyway, so this is where we work.
Welcome back to Deep in Bear Country, a Berenstain Bearcast. I'm your host, Phil Gonzalez, and on July 11th of this year, two amazing things happened. One, I turned 41. It was my 41st birthday. And two, Brad Mariska, Jeremy Gloff, and I arrived in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where we went to meet with Mr. Mike Berenstain himself at the Berenstain Bears studio. The location is a secret. The look is a secret. Everything we did was kept a little bit under wraps because we wanted to respect his privacy. And he asked us, please respect my privacy. On this day, we drove up to Mike Berenstain's house, the house of him he shares with his wife, and that also houses the Berenstain Bears studio, and met with Mike, sat with him for a good hour, and then got to explore the archives. And what were the archives? What are the archives? The archives are every existing scrap of paper, note, sketch, idea, typed letter, everything that has been held onto, which is seemingly everything, related to the careers of Stan and Jan Berenstain, as well as into the present. Carefully laid out in drawers and in art drawers. I don't know what you call them. The long wooden drawers where you lay stuff down flat. Don't know what it's called. Probably a technical term. But in the course of several hours, Brad, Jeremy, and I got to not only pick the brain of Mike Berenstain, but dig through the history of this book series, the history of his parents' careers, and hear some amazing stories about not only the creation of the Berenstain Bears, but also the publishing industry in general, the entertainment world in general, just learning what it's like to be part of a massive media juggernaut that seems to exist solely by its own power. But one thing you learn talking to Mike about the history of this book series, the history of these characters, these bears, is that everything that's happened, every book that's come out, has been the result of a decision that they made to keep the characters viable. And I think that's a good takeaway from this whole thing. As we talked to Mike, to learn that this didn't happen by accident, and this didn't happen through momentum. This happened through careful planning, learning, and because the people in charge were the Berenstains themselves, who seem to have always been very smart, very shrewd artists and business people. And so what you're going to be hearing now is excerpts from our interviews. We arrived at the studio and then Mike just invited us to sit down, and he began by talking about the artistic process, and then the conversation immediately veered widely into other discussions. So I hope you get a fragment of the satisfaction out of this conversation that we did, because it was amazing and overwhelming. So without further ado, here is some of our conversation with Mr. Mike Berenstain.
When you're doing any kind of commercial art, or you know, pop art, or whatever you want to call it, you obviously, you're thinking in terms of, you know, you're not Van Gogh thinking, I'm going to paint the haystack, and
right.
I don't care if anybody wants it or not, you know. Yeah. And if it doesn't work out, I can shoot myself. You know, that's not how you're thinking.
You know, I hope you're not thinking that.
You're thinking in terms of, I want to do a certain kind of work that I like to do, and it's going to be sold to somebody. So you're always thinking in terms of, well, what might somebody want to consume, want to buy,
sure,
or use in some way. But aside from that, so, you know, I'm not, there are things I might think would be fun to do, which I don't consider doing professionally because I don't think anybody would buy them.
Right.
Like, I think it would be fun to do Tales from Shakespeare, where you do Bernstein Bear adaptations of all the Shakespeare plays. You guys
would.
But I don't think the publishers would do very well with it.
Right.
So I don't do
But
I can work it into a plot.
Well, and there was going to be, I remember at one time, a Cubs Garden of Verses. They were taking, and that was going to be adapted into a Berenstain Bears sort of story, but it never came out.
It came out because it never made the cut from the publisher's point.
Okay.
That's something my mom and dad wanted to do.
And that was interesting, though, because that one got as far as being announced.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, I'm getting off topic already, but like,
I don't remember the details. I remember my mom wanted to do it because that was her favorite book growing up, Robert Louis Stevenson's Garden of Verses.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she said it would be a fun thing to do. We do have finally coming out with Zondervan, because I get mixed up sometimes. Books sort of bounce back and forth between HarperCollins and Zondervan. And it started out as a HarperCollins book, but it wound up as a Zondervan book called Poems and Prayers.
Okay. Oh, I saw that one.
I took some of the things my dad wrote, just as from that.
Yep.
Some of them were originally for that, and adapted them. I didn't really adapt them. I just picked ones that would work as a Zondervan book.
Right.
And then I wrote a whole bunch of original poems that would work for Zondervan, and said, "Here, you want to do it?" And they said, "Yeah." So they're doing it, and they're using pickups from various artwork as illustrations.
Okay.
So that worked out.
That's cool.
But there's little bits and pieces from that originally.
And that's fun to hear, and it's also fun to know that like some of those things that maybe didn't make it to the publishing stage like were kept.
Yeah, well, I have files to show you. It's unpublished material.
Right.
And sometimes if I think, well, wait a minute, we're doing this, maybe there's something in there that could be somewhere. I think any author or anybody.
Well, even composers and songwriters do that.
Yeah. So nothing ever really dies. It just.
And also sometimes I really push to do things like that, and the publishers just don't go for it.
Right.
Yeah, something you wrote in an email that really resonated with me is just because something's a good idea doesn't mean the public wants it from the Berenstain Bears.
Yeah, the one we were talking about was. We talked actually about that in the car on the way up here about Lose a Friend, which.
I didn't. People didn't want that.
Which is too bad.
And people have been telling me they want, people for years have been saying, got to do a book about death and loss.
Right.
And I finally said, okay. I talked my parents into it and published it. And I thought it was a very nice, sweet book. It's always been a real loser.
That's interesting.
It sounds just enough to stay in print.
I wonder why that's the case. Because it seems like every series
has. The problem is that there's lots of kind of, people think, the Berenstain Bears, we like the books that deal with life issues and life problems and they're very valuable. But they don't think about why they like them at that particular time in your life when they buy them, and they think, well, this was a problem. It's retrospective. It doesn't always work what you think back to would be good to actually translating into what people will want when that thing is happening in their lives.
Right. So, when that happens, you don't think, I'm going to go to Barnes & Noble and buy a book about.
Now, in retrospect, that seems obvious that it's an off-putting thing in terms of if somebody has a death in the family or death of a pet. They're not necessarily going to be going looking. I mean, they may find a book, but also there's a difference between mass market and trade. I mean, term.
Yeah.
That's kind of an old-fashioned term now. Used to be it was a very rigidly defined areas like trade books were books that sold in bookstores, the book trade, and mass market was everywhere else. Walmart and so on, supermarkets. But it's still a distinction in terms of. You can have a book that's a hardcover book that sells for $14 and is sold in bookstores, and it only has to sell maybe a couple thousand copies a year to be financially successful for everybody. But if you're doing, and so people looking for a book about death or loss, they will go find that book, and it's kind of perennial book that'll stay in print and it'll function that way. And it only have to have a couple thousand people a year who want it.
Right.
But if you're doing books that are mass market lines that have to go out and sell like at least 30,000 a year in order to stay in print and be functional commercially, or not that many, but in order to function commercially, be successful, that's not a book that people are going to, they have to be able to buy it as an impulse. They have to see it in Walmart, in the planogram.
Who is death book?
And so a death book doesn't work out.
Right.
It has to be, that's a subject that can work as a children's book, but not for a mass market Bernstein Bear.
And that's so funny. Like, it's so funny that, you know, as much as I've, you know, thought about this and brainstormed ideas for, you know, titles, like some a concept as simple as that, like, never occurred. But it also explains why, you know, like the books like Get in a Fight and Messy Room just keep selling.
Right. Because and even they're thinking, everybody has, kids have messy rooms all the time.
Yeah.
So right. you go in the supermarket or Barnes & Noble, the spinner rack, and you see messy room. Oh, I have messy room. That's, I need that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So those are the ones that are universal, constant themes that everybody, and it also has to do with books that aren't problem-solving books. They can just be a subject matter. Like Trip to the Aquarium.
Right.
I Can Read book has been very successful.
Yeah. I like
everybody
that.
Everybody's always going to the aquarium all the time.
Yeah, right. I love that.
Oh, my kid likes aquarium. So.
Yeah.
Why not? So it can work that way too. But a subject that might be very interesting to me or you, like, you know, the Bernstein Bears, you know, learn about medieval tapestries. That's not going to go over.
Wait, you mean you're not marketing directly at 40-year-old men?
No, that would be very interesting. To me.
Maybe a boutique line.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we tried that. I'll tell you another sad thing for me, and I'm sure you know these books.
At this point, Mike goes to the bookshelf and pulls out one of the Bernstein Bears hardcover books that were published in the early 2000s. They are larger format, picture book style books that tell the same basic stories, but in a more prestige, higher price point format.
Right. People don't want these books they don't sell because they're too expensive.
Oh, yeah.
Our audience.
Like, to their mind, it's like it's got to be a certain price point, a certain.
Yeah, $4.
Right, because they all cost $4. Right. Why would I pay $12?
Why am I paying $12? And yeah. People who are in the market for $12 children's books. They're not particularly attracted to buying, paying a lot of money for it because those are cheap books.
But do the large hardcover, like the Christmas books, sell better because they're a specialty item? Or? Because wasn't there an old-fashioned Christmas one in that line?
Well, that didn't sell well.
It didn't sell?
It didn't.
I love that.
The only one, things have different patterns, but you know, like it varies so much and you never really know what's going to happen. Like the first book we did with HarperCollins, Save Christmas.
Yeah.
Which has a very elaborate, complicated gestational history. Which
Just come out when I met you the first time.
That was the first one we did with HarperCollins. Yeah. And HarperCollins, they, this is great. We're going to do our first Bernstein Bears book. They did a huge Christmas promotion of it. They put like 100,000 out there into the marketplace, all over the place. And then, you know, about 20,000 came back as returns, and then it was dead after that. So that's a very classic kind of publishing story. And it went out of print.
Yeah.
The other ones, they didn't oversell them in, but they've just kind of percolated along. Now they're trying something with this and another one. They're going to adapt them as shorter board books, large format board books, simplified for young kids. That might work.
Yeah.
Because they'll be inexpensive and for young kids. Picture books, and this has been happening over years. Picture books have not being bought for kids over like even kindergarten. It's increasingly younger.
Okay,
right.
I think it started with the whole movement toward kids learning to read in kindergarten. Once you get to kindergarten, parents expect the kids to, here, read this book.
Right.
It's not like we're going to sit and read this book to you. Yeah. So the picture book market, which used to go up until the first, second grade levels, when my parents started, and I started, now is really focusing on preschool.
Yeah.
So books that are more complicated, that are picture books, they're very difficult to sell because people want, they expect books for kids once they're 5 or 6 or even 4 to be, you know, read it yourself. So I Can Read books, you know, easy reading books, they do very well if they're level readers.
Yeah.
Right.
Because you can, people want, oh yeah, this is the right level reader for my kid. You
know? Yeah.
And do the Bears do well in those level readers? Yeah.
Increasingly.
Yeah, that's what we've been just noticing that just in the stores, like with my 6-year-old. Like, there's just, she gravitates towards the readers.
Yeah,
because she feels confident reading them. She likes the stories.
Yeah, well, that happened. Well, goes way back, many decades. But you know, when I started in children's books, and certainly my parents, kids didn't start to learn to read until first grade.
Yeah,
and that's been gradually changing over the decades, and so that shifted the whole nature of, you know, what books are for what kids. When I was growing up, it was quite common to get books with very elaborate illustrations that were intended for kids like, you know, 8, 9, 10.
Sure.
And they had very complicated text, but then a very elaborate illustration. So the whole world of picture books has gradually shifted younger and younger over the years. Mm.
Yeah.
Even the classic Bears on Wheels got reformatted as I Can Read, didn't it, recently? The soft cover?
Yeah, it got reformatted as a board book.
Okay. Right? Oh, yeah, that's right.
Or maybe it was...
No, Bears on Wheels was Step Into Reading.
Step Into Reading.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, Old Hat, New Hat, right. And He Bear, She Bear are... I love those board books.
Yeah.
Old Hat, New Hat we were introduced to as a board book.
Right.
Really?
And it wasn't until... I feel like I had never read it before when I was a kid. And it wasn't until I just nabbed an old copy of it that I realized
there
was
extra
text.
Pages. Yeah.
More
text,
yeah. More of the story.
Because it's not just physically smaller like in this way, but like there's some skipped
over.
Of course, it used to be the children's picture books were much longer.
Yeah.
And that started to change. And I don't know if that's continued to be the problem, but I guess in the 90s, there was a huge paper cost problem, increasing paper costs that publishers had to deal with. And so they dealt with it in order to maintain their price points by reducing the number of pages in books.
Mm.
So it used to be quite common to have 64, 48 page books because it has to do with how the signatures fold, how do you do it.
Right.
And they started going down to 32, and now they're all 24.
Well, and that's so funny too because I have a lot of...
It has to do with paper costs.
I have a lot of friends who are just introducing, you know, their kids now to the first time books. And of course, they had them when they were a kid. But they're talking about how, like, oh, I read this book to my kid at night and I forgot how long it was.
Yeah, that's one of my friends said yesterday.
Because they basically don't make books that are that length anymore.
That's right. And also kids, frankly, I assume attention. Kids' attention span is reducing. Partly because of this thing.
Yeah.
Everywhere I go, I see kids going like this.
Yeah.
Even little tiny kids. And so, you know, why are they going to sit still for a long 32-page book with a lot of discussion of how we feel about things?
My kid made me sit and read the entirety of Giddy Grandma the other night.
Oh. Dude. Well, I'm not saying that all... I'm talking about
the mainstream.
I wish he had slightly smaller attention span. I know it seems short, but for Daddy's voice, it's a long read.
Well, let me show you.
Yeah, why don't you show us
the
process.
Actual work process?
Yeah.
You know, basically, we're working on. Here's the schedule.
I love that. Again, this is a part of the process you don't think about how each like step of the process has its own deadline.
Right.
Which is really important when you got 20
and
books on it.
It's very complicated. And the reason I do so many books, and I work with Marianne, and I work with the freelancer, because the artwork obviously is the most time-consuming part.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do all the illustrations. In fact, I've got to the point where I'm mainly doing the covers and reworking the illustrations of the other artists. But the reason I do that is because that's what the publishers want to do. That's what they want to publish lots and lots and lots of books, because that's how they view they can be hold their place in the marketplace.
Okay.
And you know, if they wanted to do like a couple of books a year and they felt they could be perfectly happy, I would do that, but that's not what they want to do.
Mm.
And so as long as I'm, you know, working with these publishers, I try to conform to how they want to do things.
Sure.
And you think about it, it makes sense because, you know, what's if you go into like the local supermarket and you look at the planogram of all the kids' books. What's there? It's Frozen. It's whatever.
Yeah.
It's Despicable Me.
Yeah,
there's no regular. There's maybe a few. There's no regular kids' books there. It's all just this gigantic flood of media tie-in stuff. And for the publishers publishing things like the Berenstain Bears or whatever else, you know, other things like that, which have, you know, a media connection, but they're mainly children's book,
right.
You know, based things. In order to compete with that vast machinery of Disney and all the other studios and entertainment entities that are cranking out children's books as simply like a subsidiary byproduct of the media world. It's like, you know, it's like when you're slaughtering hogs, they'll use like the gristle to make something.
Right.
for Disney or something like that, children's books is just like the gristle. Well, we might as well get some money out of that.
Yeah.
It's just like a tiny little byproduct to them, like, you know, meat juice or something.
meat juice.
Yeah, that's how they view it. It's a tiny minuscule, but they figure they're going to make money from whatever way they can from their properties that they're putting out as movies or TV shows or videos. And for it to compete with that in the kind of tiny, you know, almost amateur world of publishing, they have to try to do these extensive lines of books.
Yeah.
Because otherwise they can't get any placement in the stores.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yep.
Obviously with e-commerce, it's different. Although not that different. They have to work with Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com to get placement for their products and visibility for it. Unless you're putting out new stuff all the time, the people who are selling stuff, they're not interested. They want new stuff all the time. So that's the way business works.
Yeah.
Anyway, so anyway, you start with a whole proposal for different books. And then as we come to this stage in the schedule, you know, I'm delivering manuscripts and they're edited. And when we get the manuscript locked in place, the final version with the editors, then we start a sketch version. And here's a, I'm working on a sketch cover version for a Lift the Flap book. Get ready for bed. I was kind of reviewing stuff that we've done before about Get Ready for Bed, and I kind of like this scene from one of the old books. And I thought, well, I'll adapt that because that's a cute scene. And also, I had done other books about going to bed, which I don't want to mimic.
Yeah.
I have other books that I don't want the covers to all be distinctive. And I thought, well, this is a distinctive kind of scene, look, brushing their teeth, so I'll adapt that. So I just, you know, started.
It looks like you. It looks like you've made Papa look a little less discouraged.
Right, right. He's more amused. But anyway, this book is about, and eventually it was adapted to Bedtime Battle from HarperCollins.
Yep.
It was a similar story, but it's a comic book about the trials and tribulations to parents of getting kids ready for bed, and you know the parents wind up exhausted and fall asleep. Which it's a gag. It's like one of the old All in the Family series. It's kind of Berenstain Bear book. It's not really a book that teaches a moral or a lesson. It's simply, it's a funny family situation. This book really doesn't, it deals with the same kind of subject of them going to bed, but it's not about how they become exhausted. And it's a Lift the Flap book. It's about finding places to find cute things under flaps. So having him look so discouraged really didn't make any sense.
Right.
I just have him look like, oh, isn't it cute? They're such cute kids. And that's. Yeah.
What is it like to work with the character of Honey Bear? Because she doesn't figure into a lot of plots.
Well, she does. She's more and more.
Is she aging?
I've aged her. She's maybe two.
So she does. So she is.
She's like an active toddler now.
Okay.
She's running around.
Okay.
But sometimes, you know, she's tired and Mama picks her up. And
yeah.
Her up. So she functions as an advanced, almost problematical toddler. And sometimes she's actually in the more recent, past 5 years, she's gotten to be more and more of a figure.
Like this book that we did for Ideals.
Oh, yeah.
She's the main instigator of the plot. In this
right.
Book. And so she's like she could be like a nuisance little toddler sister.
That was something I actually kind of noticed.
She winds up in the end.
Oh, okay.
The kind of the instigator of trouble. So that's her.
Well, I noticed like the corollary I saw when I in like to this book was in a lot of Disney films, how a lot of times like the sidekick doesn't say much, or maybe there's an animal that can't speak, but still is integral to the plot.
Right.
And
sometimes it depends on what the subject is.
Right.
I mean, I'm working a book now about, I'll show you the two different versions of the cover. Because I couldn't decide which way to go with it, so I'm going to let the publishers decide. This is for Zondervan.
Oh.
And these are cover designs.
The book Mike shows us at this point is called Why Do Good Bears Have Bad Days? And he shows us two separate covers, one which features brother and sister caught in a thunderstorm while walking their, it looks like, deflated bikes up a sunny, well, no longer sunny dirt road as a couple of rabbits look on with concern, and there's lightning in the sky, and the rain is pouring, and the bears look frightened, staring over their shoulder, and the title, Why Do Good Bears Have Bad Days, is written in a somewhat spooky font. The other cover is also for Why Do Good Bears Have Bad Days, but the title is written in a colorful, more playgroundy font, and it shows the cubs riding their bikes up the dirt road, but they simply have run over a bunch of nails, the tires are flat, and the bunnies are still there, but they don't look as concerned. They look more amused, and the bears look more shocked at what has happened than frightened. It's two extremely different tones for the same exact story.
Very different, huh?
I'll tell you which one I like.
Yeah, I like this one too.
Oh, of course.
But the thing is that I'm going to let them decide because I've found, and this is, you kind of second guess yourself in dealing with the marketplace. This is what I like. And I thought, yeah, this is fun. Isn't that great? But because of the increasing movement of books toward younger and younger children, and also I've noticed just from the world and feedback over the years that over the past 10 years, parents have become, I guess it's kind of overprotective.
Sure, that makes sense.
Wildly overprotective about their children, about what they're exposed to and what's going to frighten them or alarm them or disturb them or inconvenience them. That might... For somebody these days buying a book for a 3-year-old, and also
oh, these books really aren't appropriate for 2 and 3 year olds. People buy them for like, kids one or two.
Right.
I mean, these subject matters are really more for like kids 5, 6, 7, 8.
Yeah.
But what are you going to do? People buy them for young kids. Like somebody looking at that say, oh, do I want to get that for my little 2-year-old who's right. scared of thunderstorms? And the answer is maybe no. So I thought, well, maybe I'd do one that was a more comic and antic. And so that's possible.
I like those rabbits a lot.
Yeah, me too. But I figured, you know, okay, I like this cover too. I like this idea too.
Yeah.
It's funnier. It's more comic. Bright. It's more antic.
Yeah.
Oh, it's on the new side. With their marketing and sales.
Discuss.
The book that had caught my eye on Mike's drawing board, the cover, was an upcoming book called Stand Up to Bullying. And it featured Too Tall and his gang circled around our favorite hoopy-capped tough, Scuzz, who's looking very, very, very distressed as his own gang is mocking him and ridiculing him, while Brother, Sister, and Honey Bear look on with angry looks on their faces.
This is actually coming before that. This is a story about bullying for Zondervan, about bullying amongst bullies that Brother and Sister and Honey Bear learn about, you know, like subsets of bullying. So
oh, yeah.
Scuzz gets bullied by the rest of the gang.
Like most kids picked, who bully are
yeah,
because
he,
they
he,
got bullied.
Right. And then it deals with, and the Zondervan yeah. connection is that, well, I'll show you the whole book.
Mike then has a sit down as he pulls out the official file for the Berenstain Bears Stand Up to Bullying. It's the complete artwork, the complete layout, everything. It's all ready to go and, of course, is about to go out to stores any month now. And it's really a unique feeling to see these books before the rest of the public does. It's not really so much that we are privileged as we feel honored to be trusted with the just seeing these things in advance. Obviously, you know, soon enough, the entire public will be able to see these books and purchase them. But it's nice to be there and to be allowed to hold these proofs and to be allowed to see these stories before they go out to the public. And the file is thick and it has pretty much everything related to the book right there. And later on, when we explore the archives, we're going to see that there are many, many, many such files like this for every book about the Berenstain Bears ever written.
And this is the file on the book, and it's final edited, you know, drafts, edited versions, preliminary versions as it goes along.
So how many people does it, like, go through on its
way? Well, that depends. I mean, it used to be, and Zondervan still does it this way, it used to be you had, you know, a main editor, whoever that it is, like editor of the line, and then there'd be a copy editor, and there'd be an art director who would have designers working for her. All those people would have a hand in editing and processing the text and illustration. These days, some publishers, they really don't have art directors.
Mm.
They just have designers. And that's a problem because very often the designers don't have an overall view of how a children's book works in the art department and how it's integrated with the text. So you tend to kind of get a compartmentalization of function rather than integrating them into one whole process. And so things can get kind of choppy and at cross purposes, which I find annoying. Fortunately, Zondervan doesn't do it that way. They still have an art director.
This is awesome.
They're old fashioned. They're still out in Grand Rapids, so they haven't caught up with the modern efficient methods, which really don't work very well. But then the other thing that occurs is then they also, at certain stages, the marketing and salespeople will also be looking at them, especially covers.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, I think the marketing salespeople don't really care about anything much except the cover. They just, mm-hmm. they simply, in terms right. of the interior of the book, I don't think they're not reviewing it.
Well, it's like that scene in Elf, where he's got like a blank page in the middle. Like,
oh, yeah, I always.
Because it's got a great cover.
I thought Elf was, that whole publishing part of Elf was hilarious to me because it was so based on Hollywood
yeah.
rather than publishing.
Right.
It was all about pitching.
Yeah.
Nobody pitches books. That's Hollywood. Pitching is a ridiculous thing that they do in Hollywood, where somebody just makes up something as they're going right. in an elevator and then goes into an office and say, I just had this great idea. I'm going to pitch it to you. Nobody does that in publishing. It's all formal written proposals.
And in children's books, especially.
And also the idea that they had one book that they wanted to publish to save their life.
Right.
Who's publishing? Even small publishers. They're publishing hundreds of titles.
If you had to go to New York and pitch every single book,
you'd like never have time to actually draw.
There's no pitching in publishing. I mean, the only thing equivalent to that is internal. I mean, you'll have media sales conferences and marketing conferences where the editorial staff will pitch a line to the marketing and salespeople. So that's, yeah, but it's not for creating what the book is, not from the beginning stage with an author or a creative team. But that's, you know, the people who did Elf, that's what they know. They know the world of Hollywood. Right. They don't think about publishing. They assume everything's like that.
It was at this point that Mike discussed his sort of history with Hollywood. A lot of the stories he shared with us, he shared off the record because they are, you know, not related to the subject matter at hand. But trust me, there were some good stories. We're going to leave the episode here now. This was just a taste of some of the conversation we had with Mike. As we go into the archives in upcoming episodes, we will, of course, not be able to show you to your ears a lot of the things that we saw. But what I'm going to do is, for this episode as well, I'm going to include as many pictures on my blog as I can relating to the subjects that we were discussing. So if you go to berenstainbearcast.wordpress.com, if you're not already there, I will have pictures from this episode up on that blog. Now, the pictures were not only taken by myself, they were also taken by Brad Mariska and Jeremy Gloff. So I will have credit for those photos if they were not taken by me. But I hope you enjoyed this brief jaunt into the visit with Mike Berenstain. I hope you learned as much as we did, and I will be back next week with more Berenstain Bear Madness. We have more chapter books coming up, so please, please, please join me here. Later on, I will post more from our interviews, more from our trips. This isn't the only stop we made. We also went to the archives at the Strong National Museum of Play, as you may have heard from our last discussion. So join me again next week as we continue to explore this wonderful world here deep in Bear Country.